Ross has huge savings on looks that are 100% you, so you can find all the styles that match your vibe, from stylish skorts to jersey tees. The trendiest looks of the season will have you saying, "It's a yes for me." Plus, they've got shoes to make any fit pop. Be the best dressed for less with your favorite picks of the season. Head to Ross and save 20 to 60% off other retailers' prices. Items and styles vary by store.
Hey, it's Farm Girl. Welcome to Talk Farm to Me's Straight Talk series. This is episode 4. We've already talked bison and about being a conscious carnivore. We've talked justice for black farmers and about food deserts. We've jumped into goat farming and the fact that upwards of 80% of farms have at least one farmer working in an off-farm job. Today, we go straight into the deep, dark world of mushrooms. I had no idea how exciting this world could be. From shiitakes to psychedelics, from foraging to morel cultivation. And then into the mysterious world of mycelium. My head is still reeling from all of the interesting ideas that I had the chance to discuss with mushroom farmer Matt Hall of Midnight Harvest in Northern Michigan. I'm super excited to talk with you. There's so much to know. And I was coming up with really awesome questions to ask you. And then I did a little research and I was like, well, that's a myth. So let's start there. Let's start with mushroom myths, because I think there are a lot of them out there and they don't seem to go away. I'm sure you've probably told people a million times, you know, debunking the myths, but somehow they persist. And I'd love to hear maybe a little list of myths.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I think the myth is, what I hear from is they like love darkness. That's like the number one.
Right.
And for some reason, even though their connection to light is the same as ours, and that UVB irradiation coming from the sun, we have a cholesterol in our epidermis, in our skin, that reacts to that irradiation, which creates vitamin D. Well, they have the same reaction. So in fact, mushrooms are actually akin to the sun. So they have that same chemical reaction. That's one of the big myths. I think that, you know, when you talk about mushrooms, aside from what kind you grow, you know, usually referring to psilocybin, which I don't whatsoever, that, yeah, like, oh, they grow in the dark. I'm like, no, we give them 5 hours of light every day and they benefit from actual sunlight. So it's just that they're found in shaded areas due to the moisture content normally. So anywhere in that, any system of mushroom cultivation, there's always going to be moisture. But in like nature, they're prone to moisture. You know, that's where they have to keep a certain moisture content.
And you're growing your mushrooms indoors. And so what kind of light are you giving them?
We just give them LED light. It's really simple. They benefit from it. We've actually done without LED and no LED, they're almost albino. And so it does create a pigmentation. Like the maitakes go from like light gray to really dark gray. The shiitakes will go from jet white to brown. So they do benefit from LED. Whether they're getting the UVD synthesis occurring under LED is probably not happening, because we have that LED going through a plastic barrier. And so most plastics prevent UVA, UVB from transparenting through them. So it's probably not happening, but you can expose mushrooms to light and induce the reaction even after they've been cut from their substrate. So we're just giving simple LEDs. It's really a lot. Some smaller growers use LED commercial, like ribbon lights, like the rope lights. We just have an overhead LED. It works really easy.
Incredible. I'm learning so much already and I have questions, but there were some things I can't even pronounce, but we're going to get back to those.
All right.
So there's, I think, another myth around spores, that we're growing mushrooms from spores. Now, where are spores? Are there spores? And what are we actually growing mushrooms from?
There's definitely like billions of spores, but spores are the genetic next code. So you and I are spores of our parents, if you will. And we, in fact, in mushroom cultivation, we grow from tissue. So just like a strawberry or any other rhizome can be have a plant cutting, it's pretty much a similar process where you can clone what you're working with. And that's the same way. So we can cut open any mushroom. We can take a little tissue from inside the mushroom itself. There's a sterile tissue. We can take that out and then put that to a high nutrient media like potato dextrose agar or agar media. I use malt agar. And we can then clone it in the lab and regrow that mushroom. And it's the same genetic code. It's not the next generation. So spores are definitely, we don't grow from spores at all.
Interesting. So when you have a really awesome mushroom, for example, mm-hmm. you can just take pieces of that. You don't have to go to the mushroom store and get more mushrooms to plant. You just use what you have?
I don't. I buy through a commercial spawn provider. For the reason being, spawn, the tissue that we buy, it's an art form. People who know how to produce spawn, that's what they focus on. Whereas I know how to produce a mushroom. And so it's almost like the seed supplier versus the plant grower. So how people will bring in plants from another nursery, same process. I can produce my own spawn. I've done it before. It is very tricky. And you have to just kind of look at your offset. Like, do I want to put time and effort into this? Or do I want to buy it to save me time to put efforts elsewhere? But then you get into like a big production and we're not that big, so I don't have to worry about it. But I think I would have a tipping scale. Once I'm full time into it, you know, I'm 3/4 of the way of being full time. And so once I'm full time, then I have to go, okay, well, where am I going to save the most money? And now that my time is freed up, I can focus on spawn and we can probably prove it's our own if we so choose.
And so what part of the mushroom does the spawn come out of?
The tissue, so if you took a mushroom cap and, you know, the stem and the cap and right in the sweet spot is kind of where they meet. It's the most amount of meat in the mushroom. And you could split it open and take a sterile scalpel and remove tissue from that mushroom because it's completely sterile inside there. There's no bacteria, there's no mold, and that's where it comes from. And so theoretically, one mushroom, this was covered in a book called Mycelium Running, one mushroom, a little tissue clone can produce millions of pounds of mushrooms because it just keeps running. Now they do say that it has senescence, which is eventually cloned too much and it's gonna tire out. So a lot of producers will have what's called second generation or first generation master spawn, where it's the closest to the mushroom clone as possible. They're not giving you something like a seventh generation spawn where it could be very tired out. The goal is to continually feed it something different because if you keep feeding it the same thing, it will tire, as they say. But I've never gotten to that point, so I don't know the actual results from taking it to a seventh generation. Right now with like certain mushrooms like the morel, we can take it across. I've had the same strain in the lab for 3 years, and that strain come from Penn State. And so imagine having like a strawberry and you've kept it alive for 3 years indoors and is just as strong as it was the day you got it. So it's really nice.
And when you say in the lab, what do you mean?
So the kind of mushroom growing that like gourmet mushrooms, like shiitake, maitake, lion's mane, oyster reishi, that kind of gourmet category, we all require a lab because we require a sterile technique. Whereas white button portobello, that's a pasteurization technique. And it's not to say that like the spawn that they have is very clean, but their process is not clean at all. And so they spawn out on large beds of substrate and the mushroom runs through the substrate and then it produces white button portobello. And usually that substrate is pasteurized cow manure or pasteurized horse manure. Whereas in the lab, our entire process is sterile up until we produce the mushroom. So essentially, the shiitake cycle is 10 weeks. 8 out of the 10 weeks is sterile. And they're held in controlled bags. All of my bags have a 0.2 micron filtration. And a spore, like a mold spore, is like 1 micron. And so we all have flow hoods, that we work in front of, like I just worked in front of today, that we turn the flow hood on, and the flow hood's now producing 0.3 micron filtrated air, which is extremely, like HEPA filter 99.97, and some get to 99.99. And then for about 2 hours, we're in front of a flow hood or more, depending on how many bags you're gonna do, inoculating very carefully. Eventually it's muscle memory. So just like playing a guitar, I mean, half the time I'm listening to a podcast, which I listen to some of yours, they're wonderful. You know, I caught up or music, and you know, you're just in the flow, but you're an entirely sterile flow. There's gloves on, there's alcohol out, there's a process. And if I, even if my shirt were to nick the bag, I have to mark that bag knowing like I overstepped the sterile flow hood area. So, and there's a chance that if a mold spore got in there, you're done with. Mold reproduces 1,000 times faster than its counterparts like gourmet mushrooms. So if there's mold anywhere in that bag, it's over.
It can't compete with mold? Is that it?
It can't compete with mold at all, because mold will reproduce and reproduce and reproduce way faster than mycelium can run. That being said, there are mushrooms that can compete with mold. Like oyster mushrooms can actually eat mold. And maitakes can actually eat mold. They have defensive mechanisms that can actually defend against them. Shiitake has no defense mechanism. It will lose. I've seen it happen. Whereas maitake, I've seen win. I've seen oysters win. A little mold patch gets in there and it's tiny. They'll circle it and they'll eat it entirely. And that's their job, is to eat things. So it works.
I'm really not usually speechless, but I'm a little speechless. I need to see mushrooms eating mold. It just feels like Godzilla versus King Kong.
Oh, it totally is. I love it. I just can't imagine what's happening on the molecular level between those two species going, no, it's my house, and you know, fighting over that little space.
So speaking of, you're using, when you're checking the growth, you're using a microscope.
So with the microscope, the microscope work is mainly for the morels. So we can determine certain aspects of their culture and of their growth. And we can look at their mycelium, and we have two microscopes. We have a stereo and we have a compound. Stereo is for like things you see with the naked eye. You just want a closer look. And then compound, of course, things that you need higher magnification. And so that's mainly my microscope work, is for like all the morel work that we do. And so we can look at mycelium and we can see individual thread, and are there differences? Are there not differences? That kind of observation.
Okay, let's back up for 1 second, because I want people to understand on a simpler level here before, I mean, we are getting into it and I'm very excited about it. And I'm gonna ask you to explain some things, maybe even a second time, because it's really fascinating. But the mushrooms that you're growing, so you're growing shiitake. Mm-hmm. Tell us all of the mushrooms that you're growing right now.
I grow only shiitake and maitake, and then we research and grow on a small scale morel. So on commercial production, shiitake and maitake.
And what kind of level of production are you talking about? Like pounds wise?
With shiitake, we're about 40 to 45 pounds per week. And with maitake, we're about 15 to 20 pounds per week. So I'm still pretty small. I'm conservatively, you know, to other farms who I look up to, they're into the 300 to 400 pounds per week. And that's where we're headed next. We're headed to the 150 to 200 pounds per week marker. We're planning that out right now.
Right. And so who are your customers?
Restaurants and retail outlets. I don't have a direct to consumer outlet yet. I've never been to a farmer's market, and we don't have a storefront, one that I want right now. So right now, just restaurants and retail.
Right. And so these mushrooms, I mean, I think you're going to have to explain to me. I know a shiitake very well, but I don't know if I can visualize a maitake. Explain to me what they look like.
Maitake, they're called hen of the woods, or the dancing mushroom.
Oh, okay. I know it by hen of the woods.
Okay, there you go. Yep. Maitake is just Grifola frondrosa is the technical term. Maitake, I think, is the Japanese term. And then, of course, hen of the woods is its nickname. So, yeah, we grow those. And they're amazing and they're gorgeous. And all of my chefs love them. It's just one mushroom you can't get fresh enough.
Yeah, that's really incredible. I was thinking about mushrooms, and I'm not sure if you mentioned it somewhere, or someone else mentioned it to me, that basically mushrooms were relegated to pizza. You know, a couple of decades ago, it was just like the only place mushrooms appeared were out of a can and on a pizza. And now mushrooms are a real delicacy. For people who don't eat meat, they are the meat. So yeah, I'm just very curious. I do see mushrooms at farmers markets, and some of them really freak me out. I mean, they're, you know, really interesting shapes. What is kind of the king or queen of mushrooms?
I would say, I mean, the original king would be white button portobello, but the up and coming and surpassing is certainly gourmet. And when you get into the gourmet category, that's shiitake. And I think so for the reason of, if you look at other mushrooms like lion's mane, maitake, oyster, they're all actually clumping mushrooms. They all come from usually one fruiting body. And so it makes it very intimidating. Whereas shiitake is very tasty, and it's very much like white button portobello. There's a single cap and a single stalk. And it makes it similar to work with and cook with. Whereas if you're breaking down a lion's mane or you're breaking down a maitake, it seems kind of daunting to cook with. It's how do you cook it? And so familiarity, I think, is one of the leading reasons shiitake has taken hold. The other mushrooms are tasty, but there's a learning curve to how you're going to use it. Not to mention, it's a mushroom. You've never seen this thing. Like lion's mane looks like coral. Shiitake doesn't cook even in the pan. We roast ours before we cook it in the pan. So it makes it difficult, I think, for consumers. Whereas, you know, shiitake, oh, I know what to do with that. It's got a cap and a stalk. You know, we're good.
I love the idea that a mushroom could be intimidating, but I definitely see what you're thinking about. I have a tangent, and I remember a story from when I was a kid, like, don't eat mushrooms that you find in the woods. You know, they could be poisonous or what have you. And then, you know, I think there was some sort of crazy story about the red cap mushroom and some spaghetti sauce and the whole family. These are terrible stories, right? Oh, yeah. And foraging. Are you, I mean, two things. One, are you a forager at all? And I'm just curious about how legends like that maybe come out of some tragedy, how they affect the world of mushrooms, especially from a culinary or retail sales perspective.
They're luckily for like retail, the retailers and the chefs know what they're buying. So that's awesome. I would say the individual consumer, when I've been a bartender for 20 years, so I still get the mushroom questions because everyone knows what I do. And the question usually we get first off is what kind of mushrooms you grow, as a joke to psilocybin. You know, I'm like, okay, not that kind. And they go, can you grow morels? I go, well, if I could, I wouldn't tell you. And then typically, you know, with mushrooms and being outdoors and foraging, I'm not a certified forager. I can pick out mushrooms here and there. And it's kind of interesting because the myth of mushrooms being all poisonous. And Peter McCoy, who founded Radical Mycology, great guy. I met him once when he came through town and went to his seminar. And he says, not a lot of mushrooms will kill you, but a lot of mushrooms will make you want to die. And, you know, they're going to run a gamut on your system. And, but then again, you know, if you look at rhubarb, not many people know that the stalk is edible, but the leaf is deadly. And so I think it's just the myth of just generational. I think it's just generational myths that carried over that were once a commercial, now are just mainstream. And yeah, I think it's just a matter of education and debunking that. And I think that's coming around. We're seeing that in people are, and what they're getting used to and what they're okay with. And that not all, yeah, you can have it look funky, but it's still healthy.
That's great. And I think that you said a fancy word for psychedelic mushrooms. Is that right?
Yeah.
Say it again.
Some psilocybes or psilocybin or cubanescens. Yeah. I mean, it's all related to, you know, psychoactive mushrooms that are being used for health in many ways, of which I don't touch. So, and for the reason of a business purposes, there's a lot of red tape there. You got to be careful.
And what is it that makes them psychedelic? I mean, it's natural to the mushroom, obviously, but what is
it? Yeah, it's a chemical in the mushroom that, you know, reacts with our brains just like, you know, certain things and sends you on an interesting time. I don't know much about it. I can't really speak to it. I've never even tried it myself. So There,
if you did, you should not confess it here.
No, I would not. No, yeah, no. You don't confess anything over the internet.
Okay, so, all right. So we've gotten through some, we understand some customers and we've debunked some myths. And I'm curious, I want to know a little bit more about your process. But before that, you know, you said you had some people that you really looked up to in the mushroom business. And I'm curious because I think that they're, you know, when I talk to farmers and I talked to a strawberry farmer out in California a couple of weeks ago. And, you know, there are some big giants in the strawberry business that do things in a really bad way. And they do it in a bad way in terms of like how they're growing, the imprint that they have on the land, you know, so there's criticism sometimes when you start getting bigger and bigger. And I'm just curious in the mushroom business, like what happens when you get really big?
You know, looking at the idea of, I guess, where you want to set yourself up for agriculture, you know, how big do you want to get from inception to a big business owner? And I would say the bigger you get, the less control you have over every part of the process. And for me, I do everything from the mopping to the sterile process. So it's just me. With, as a big business owner, you can't possibly be doing all those jobs. And so quality will go out the door eventually. Maybe you're running such a big company that margin is first up and first, and so you're willing to do anything for the margin. If it's a commodity, like other things like corn and soy, I mean, oh my gosh, I can't believe, I feel bad. You know, those farmers don't make anything. I mean, commodity, I listened to your dairy ones and I was like, holy cow, like they're just for the reason of what's being brought in. And
yeah, holy cow is right.
Yeah, literally, holy cow. You know, they have milk shortages at Publix, but they're dumping milk. I just listened to that one. I was like, what the? I love the idea of keeping the business small, you know, making it sustainable, not just like this crazy attainable goal or record, or you got 20 people working for you, because more people or more equipment, which means more problems.
So I'm curious about the bigger mushroom growers. Do they use pesticides? Are they, when I go to the grocery store and there's no label on the mushrooms other than it's a mushroom in a package and I buy that, what's in there and how does it affect the mushroom if they are using something funny?
So I can't speak for White Button or Portobello because I don't grow them. I'm not actually familiar with that cultivation. I'm familiar with a few of the basics of them, but to speak for what they're using on the mushroom to control pests, I have no idea. Luckily for like shiitake, no matter how big you get, it's still a very organic process. There's still one process that kills everything. And most places are going to start with organic or good ingredients. But a lot of the times when you get into monoculturing, and you get bigger and bigger and bigger, you have bigger and bigger problems. So in this case with shiitake, maitake, there's no problems. It's our biggest competitor is mold. It's a green mold that you see on your bread when you leave the bread out too long. So, and you're usually not even near that process when you're serving it to a customer or in a grocery store. There's no pesticides involved whatsoever. There's no sprays. The only time we ever spray the blocks is we spray them with water, just to induce the fruiting process. So luckily, even for me as a small person and for the person people, you know, 500 pounds a week, same process just scaled up. So there's no chemical input that they're putting on the actual production food that they're growing, which is amazing. Our whole process is done in a sterile procedure, which makes it perfect. We heat treat our blocks for 24 hours, which kills everything. And then from there on, the next 8 weeks is an entirely sterile process. The 2 weeks they're out of the bag, there's nothing happening.
So take me through some of the elements of the process. We've learned about spawn, mm-hmm. and then you have blocks, you said. So yeah. Take us through, you get your spawn in the mail. Woohoo, now what?
So we make a mix, and there's many mixes you can look up, and it's predominantly hardwood. A lot of the mushrooms we're growing eat hardwood material. So they're responsible for degrading all the wood that's outside. And we make a particular mix with different ingredients like wheat bran or oat bran. The bigger, the popular one online is actually soy hull. I don't use any soy hulls because I don't have any access to them. I think it's important using something locally that you can get locally and not shipped in. And then after that, we make that mix, we turn it into a block. It goes into a bag. The bag has a specialized filter on it for later. And well, the bag gets pressed. That's where the block comes from. And we press it down and then we set it, we heat treat it for about 23, 24 hours at a certain temperature, minus 208 degrees. And then once it's heat treated, we let it cool. And once it's cooled, we apply the spawn of the particular mushroom we want to grow. Now, the cool thing being is that we grow shiitake and maitake in the same mix. They don't care. So there's just techniques in fruiting them, not in growing them. And so my shiitakes and my maitakes are the same substrate, which makes it really nice and interchangeable. So after that, it all depends on the incubation time. This is like where they get in a big warehousing, because my lead time for shiitake is 8 to 9 weeks. And I'm starting 35 bags of shiitake per week. So we got 35 times at least a minimum of 9 before we get into fruiting. And so if you're a big warehouse producing even 100 bags a week, you've got 900 bags before you start rotating. So that incubation is one of the biggest places. So storage is huge. And then once they're out of the bag, once they're ready to go, they go into the fruiting room, which is a humid room. And we do it with an ultrasonic mister. Lights are on and about 4 or 5 hours a day, and then off for 19, 20 hours a day. And they're just sitting there in about a medium, anywhere from 80 to 85% residual humidity, relative humidity. And from there, they just become the mushroom. So it's pretty simple, standard process. There's not a lot of, it's not to say that it's easy, but once you get in the flow of it, it is.
Like muscle memory, you said.
Yeah, in muscle memory, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So it sounds like it takes some, you know, pretty precise equipment and definitely some space. And you're running this at your home, or is it a separate facility?
Nope, I'm at my home. We built a room in our garage that is total square footage, about 500 square feet. And the nice thing is we use vertical integration. So I am almost to the ceiling with everything. And I have floating shelves. I call it like my library, which the wheels are holding up 600 pounds of media. And it's a little scary at times because I've had one tip over on me, and luckily we were fine. But yeah, you're moving around these racks that have 54 bags. Each bag weighs a certain amount. And we're moving around just to kind of move the library of incubation around before they go into the fruiting room. So yeah, we're vertically integrated. It makes it great for efficiency.
You have to be very organized.
Yeah.
I love that it's called fruiting.
I don't know. It's funny that like mushrooms got fruiting in there somehow, but they did.
Yeah. I'm going to call them fruit from now on.
Yeah. Cool.
Got to go get some fruit from the mushroom section. from the mushroom. So let's talk about morels. So in this part of the country, we have in the spring, we have ramp season.
Oh yeah.
And people go out and forage ramps, and some farmers are bringing ramps to farmers markets, and everybody's going ramp crazy. And then right after ramp season is morels.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's kind of like an underground cult of like the people who know where the morels are. And there's, you know, they're almost impossible to get to talk, but I know that they're out there and they're beautiful. Now they're really sought after. Am I right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All right. So what are you doing in your laboratory with the morels?
So the history behind, we call them morels up here in Northern Michigan. So we really emphasize the E. So it's always interesting.
Morels.
Yeah. But morels,
I'm probably saying it wrong.
I am saying it wrong. I am so sorry to the Morels. People say my name wrong all the time. Morel, Morel, Morel.
Morels are the total industry in the United States, in the Michigan alone would be crazy. Being that springtime mushroom that everyone goes and searches for and has their spot, and it's always elusive. The total industry in the United States is actually hard to gauge. The only one thing we can really go by, a few things, USDA did a study back in 2005, and it was only in study in two states, Washington and Oregon, and in 6 months from January until June, where all the foragers go out and pick commercial harvest, they knew it was for mainly for morel for the sake of the season, because that's kind of the only mushroom happening. And they estimated 770,000 pounds of morels were harvested from those two states in 6 months. So that's just two states in the United States.
Wow.
And they do happen across the United States and in only 6 months. And that's all what it was reported, not was that's just the permit, not what mom and pa went out and got or foragers sold independently. So it's a small narrow window into the morel season. Being that, it's a big industry. It's probably United States into the billions. If it was a regular traded commodity like white button portobello, it'd be easier to track. But yeah, it's like the one mushroom everyone's looking to find and also cultivate. And there's been some successes over the past few decades, but nothing that ever stuck. Like back in the 80s, two doctors, Dr. Ron Auer and Gary Mills, who's at, he's in Michigan. I've never met him, but I know he's in Michigan. And they actually ended up cultivating morels in their lab. But those patents are now open and nothing really ever came from them due to the difficulty level of what they were doing and the way they were doing it. And so what we came about doing is a whole different method that would be if we could tell any farm, do this, this, and this, and you could grow a morel. And it's actually, it's very viable. It's a viable equation. So
we like you.
We like me. Yeah, I say we a lot. I do have a co-founder, luckily.
Sorry, no, I'm just trying to figure out. You're like you're sitting on the secret of morels.
Yeah.
Okay. What are you going to do with that? You're going to grow them, or you're selling
an
opportunity, or what's happening?
We're definitely going to grow them, and then see what happens after that. I'm both, we have to, right now where they are, the highest we've ever got them was half an inch. But that's also because our studies have been very small. So by next week, our new studies will be about 5 to 10 times the size. And so we're actually hoping for full-blown morel. Like we're edible, we can cut them. And
you're doing this here at your house?
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh, okay. So a completely indoors. There's nothing, there's no outside, there's nothing that we're doing with the outside environment. We control every aspect of the growth. And with that, we'll begin to grow them. We'll begin to sell them and we'll take traction. And there's kind of two roads. There's either a big company comes along and says, you know, how much, or there's part of me that also has like the guy who created the polio vaccine. The guy who knew it was this important to just the world needs it. And so I am tempted to also be in that, what if we crowdfunded it? What if, you know, we did both? We got the payday, but we also gave everyone the opportunity. And that one's really leaning with me because the idea of I'm going to be a small time grower. I'll never produce this thousands on millions of pounds of morels. Because it almost seemed like it would be too, like a lot of growth always at all times. We're always going to maybe get an order. Someone's always going to call wanting more. And we're always going to be in continual growth, which is just a little exhausting. So I'm toying with the idea of what if we did one of the biggest fundraisers, Kickstarters, whatever, and we just give the answer. We just say the equation. It would be kind of fun, honestly. And also, I wouldn't have to deal in trade secret anymore.
That's pretty exciting. You're sitting on the moral secret.
Yeah, we actually
like the holy grail.
We've grown it on a petri dish. That's how holy grail we have it. We do have that's where we're at. And from an investment standpoint, all the investors who we've talked to always want to see the full morel. They always want that. Where's the product? And I go, I understand that, but the moment you see the full morel is the moment we don't need investment because we you know, right now we're already really well with the mushrooms we have, and with that one we'd be very well off. And so unlike most things or most products that need a lot of traction, that need to get into the market, you know, they need to the shelf space, we'd be the only morel in the entire world at all times. So it's a different equation. It's a different investment equation. And yeah, we haven't had very good traction with the investors. They just want to see that full morel, and I go, I'm not calling you when I get the full morel. You have to be on the, got to be on the docket when I get that. You can't be afterwards. So
it's all good. All right. Well, people out there listening are going to have some opportunities and some things to think about. The golden ticket out in the mushroom world is happening in a petri dish in Michigan right now, which is pretty cool. It's really great. Just a couple questions here. I feel like there's been a lot more like talk and love for mycelium, you know, books about trees communicating with each other and helping one another and all of this. Explain that mycelium to me, please.
So mycelium, is everything but the mushroom. So when we see the mushroom, that's the fruiting body. That's the tomato, basically. When the mycelium would be considered the stalk, the leaves around the stalk, and the roots below the stalks. And so the body itself that does all the operations is below the ground, and it's capable of some amazing things. And so the whole trend with trees communicating, I'm sure it happens. And it all depends on what passion project you want to get into. Paul Stamets, wonderful mycologist from the Pacific Northwest. He's got his mission with the bees right now, that there's a trade-off between mycelium and bees, and there's a medicine that they're gathering from it. And that's his passion. You know, he's done really well for himself, so now he's pursuing it. The cool thing about mycelium is that that's also the site of degradation. So when a mushroom is eating, it's sending out digestive enzymes into the environment around it for whatever it comes up with. And if it's like a soil-borne or a wood-borne, it's going to secrete an enzyme. The enzyme will break or unlock the code to whatever polymer they're reaching. And then they digest it into simple atomic chemicals or atomic, you know, like nitrogen, carbon, sulfites. Well, the cool thing for me, my passion project after morel, post morel, is they were found a mold in India digesting PET, digesting hard plastic. And it's a black mold, not one we really want to work with indoors, but certainly one with we can play with outside and in not too many. And they found a mushroom in the Brazilian rainforest. I think this is where it came from, but they studied it in the Netherlands. And when they treated soft plastic with UV irradiation, it was actually able to eat the plastic, and then the researchers ate the mushroom because it was edible. And nothing happens because the mushroom completely breaks down the polymers that we bound, and it says, okay, I know what to do with this. So my passion project with mycelium after this is to discover a way that we could put mushrooms to work for the waste we occur in this world. And I think there's a way, just a matter of how far that rabbit hole do you want to go down? But is it worth it? Because to me it is.
Yeah, you know, down that rabbit hole, Matt.
Yeah.
Do it.
You know, is there a chance that we could figure out a mushroom that set it in the right environment and you could inoculate landfills with it, and it eventually will turn the landfills into something better than just trash in land? Because nothing's happening there. It's all anaerobic. There's no oxygen. So Paul has his bees, I have my trash, and I want to see the, you know, something's got to happen, because we're the waste that's accumulating on a daily basis is going to need to be answered by something other than more industrial complexes, more factory farm, more farms or more factories that just burn it off. So yeah, from the exit or from the money we get from the morel products, eventually we'd immediately go into studying plastic degradation using mycelium. And there's a strong chance. We've already got two examples that happen naturally that I think that through more research, there's a really strong chance we'd find the mushroom that has the capability of digesting PET in 24 hours. And we just need to learn it. So that would be what, and mycelium is amazing because it can do this. It just, how else, you know, what other agriculture do we have that we can use to our benefits? And that's where penicillin came from. Penicillin, you know, is from a mold. And so a lot of our medicines come from mold. So it's a really, there's no end in sight with what you can do with mycelium or with, you know, fungi in general.
I hope you love talking with mushroom farmer Matt Hall as much as I did. Now you know about mushroom myths and substrate, fruiting, that maitake are the hen of the woods, that some mushrooms are intimidating, that Matt might have the secret sauce for growing morels. You could invest. And that he is planning to save the planet with mycelium. I will bet you $100 that you did not think you would learn everything you did here today, or that you could be so excited about mushrooms. I sure didn't. If you loved it, let me know. Write a review on Apple Podcasts for all the world to see, and tell your friends to listen. You can follow me, your host, on Instagram at XOXOFarmGirl, and find more information about this episode, including show notes and a full transcript at talkfarmtome.com. Stay tuned for a new episode of Straight Talk, where we will talk about Bill Gates' land grab with Georgia farmer Will Harris. And there's more. A new episode of the Deep Dive series on dairy comes out next week, and we will meet humane chicken farmer Francesca Duval of Alchemist Farm, live on Instagram for 5 Live. Find showtimes and announcements on XOXO Farm Girl on Instagram. Talk farm with you soon.
Ross has huge savings on looks that are 100% you, so you can find all the styles that match your vibe, from stylish skorts to jersey tees. The trendiest looks of the season will have you saying, "It's a yes for me." Plus, they've got shoes to make any fit pop. Be the best dressed for less with your favorite picks of the season. Head to Ross and save 20 to 60% off other retailers' prices. Items and styles vary by store.